This is the Southwest Christadelphian Bible School, the 10th of July, 2015. This is the third period, Class 5. Our speaker is Brother Stephen Hornhart from the Salisbury Ecclesia in Adelaide, UK, Australia. His theme for the week is Come and See, Witnessing for Christ. Today's title is, And the Seven Angels Prepared Themselves to Sound. Brother Stephen.
Well, good morning, brothers and sisters. Very nice to be with you once again as we commence our fifth study under the general theme, Come and See, Witnessing for Christ. And particularly this morning, we're now going to enter into the third of those chapters that we suggested that we're going to work through over this week together. We've already covered chapter 6, we've covered chapter 12, and now we're going to walk into chapter 8. Now, brothers and sisters, the events of chapter 8, so rich in drama, so rich in graphic detail, so very rich in all of those symbologies that we find in a chapter like this, are really the direct result of the answer to the prayers of the saints. In fact, we pick this up in Revelation 8 and verse 3, and we read these words. And here were our brethren and sisters, very much like the fifth seal, when our brothers and sisters cried unto God, How long, O Lord, holy and true? We also now have this wonderful prayer that goes up, and all the drama of chapter 8 comes because these were men and women who knew God was there. They knew God had not abandoned them. They knew that God was there to encourage them, and so they cried to Him in these words, chapter 8 and verse 3. And another angel came and stood at the altar, having a golden censer. Now, there are two altars in this chapter. So an angel comes and stands at an altar, the altar of burnt offering, the brazen altar, you see. He had in his hand a golden censer, and there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it up with the prayers of all saints upon the golden altar. Ah, so you have two altars, you see. Now we have the altar of incense. And in verse 4, the smoke of the incense, which came with the prayers of the saints, ascended up before God out of the angel's hand. Now picture what John sees, brothers and sisters. John sees an angel go over to the brazen altar, take the coals, move over to the altar of incense, and place the coals on the altar of incense, and then just spread that incense, and flash up it would go. And as soon as that incense ascended into heaven, into the nostrils of Almighty God, there was an immediate reaction, and the reaction was verse 5. The angel took the censer and filled it, notice this, with the same fire that ignited the prayer. So the same coals that had ignited the prayer, the angel cast those same coals to the earth, and there were voices and thunderings and lightnings. Brothers and sisters, that is an absolute immediate answer. Powerful and direct from Almighty God as these events would now unfold in Revelation and chapter 8. Now before we go into the details of these first four wind trumpets, what we need to understand, brothers and sisters, as we look at, well, in our study this morning, the introduction, and we're going to be looking at wind trumpet number 1, and then, God willing, in our final study tomorrow morning, we're going to be looking at wind trumpets 2, 3, and 4, and finish our studies with some exhortational comments as to why we have gone through this history of the angels diligently at work. However, before we look at the detail of these first four wind trumpets, what we need to understand, brothers and sisters, is the intimate, clear, contrasting link between the sixth seal, or the end thereof, and the beginning of the seventh seal. And it will really help us get our head around the drama of what the Apostle John is about to see. The end of the sixth seal and the beginning of the seventh. Well, but to do that, let's have a look at a little chart that will give us both a little bit of revision and also set the scene for what we're about to look at this morning. Now, these dates are very familiar to us, or with us, I think. 312, 313, 324, 330, and AD 337. It's all about Constantine, you see. In fact, Constantine is in the first couple of verses of Revelation 8. Now, we know from the studies that we had yesterday and the day before that when Constantine came into Rome, having beaten Maxentius, the pagan, it was now Constantine's position to be ruler of the Western Empire. He was ruling Rome. The other two emperors in the East yet had to be dealt with. And we saw in our classes thus far that in 313, Constantine got together with his brother-in-law Licinius and drew up the Edict of Milan, which would be the answer in measure to our brothers and sisters, how long. And so there was religious toleration both to Christians and to pagans. Well, then in 324, and I might say this, brothers and sisters, in that line running down there is the clear demarcation between the sixth seal, which is over here, and the seventh seal, which is over here. More about that in a moment. But in AD 324, Constantine came in, rested after all the wars in heaven, Revelation 12, those battles that took place and all the chaos that ensued thereafter, when finally Constantine had defeated his brother-in-law, cast him out forever, Constantine was now ruler of the whole empire, AD 324. Then Constantine moved his capital from Rome to Byzantium, in AD 326. It was necessary to do that because of the threat of the barbarians. So in AD 326, he moves his capital to Byzantium, which would then be called Constantinople in AD 330. Ah, now there's a new Rome, you see. And then, as do all men, Constantine died in AD 337. Now, what is important, brothers and sisters, is this section in here, from the time Constantine began to rule the world, Christianize the world, and to the time that he died. That section in there is a period of 14 years and is very much important with respect to Revelation chapter 8. Because over there, in the sixth seal was absolute chaos. And there was John with his parchment out and he was watching the events of the sixth seal. He saw the sun go black as sackcloth. The emperors were disappearing. He saw the stars cast to heaven. There was the pagan administration. And he saw the pagan religion, the moon turned to blood. Brothers and sisters, the color was vivid. When John was watching all of this flash before his eyes, the noise was deafening. The activity was frenetic, and you could see his pen on fire as he's skipping across the pages. Seeing all of this, he sees dragons drawing the third part of the stars of heaven, seven-headed dragons with 10 horns. It would have been absolutely amazing in the mind of the Apostle John. And all of a sudden, brothers and sisters, as he turns his page over to write the next events, we're taken into the seventh seal, and it goes, whoosh, nothing. Absolute stone silence. What a contrast. And John listens. Nothing. He listens again. Nothing. And in that stone silence, brothers and sisters, look at Revelation 8 and verse 1. You've got to see what John sees. You've got to picture what he sees. Well, Revelation 8 and verse 1. And when it opened the seventh seal, AD 324, there was silence in the political heavens of Rome as Constantine now rules the world. And it was for about the space of half an hour. More about that in a moment. But in the stone silence, as John is waiting for activity, action, we read in verse 2, and I saw in that stone silence seven angels. Now, brothers and sisters, picture this. John is watching, no noise, and in that deafening silence, if there is such a thing, seven angels like that, and their hands are out, and in their hands are placed 7 trumpets. You see what God's doing? Silence. Trumpets. All block your ears, John. Block your ears, because by the time each one of those angels put that trumpet to their lips, there is going to be an ear-shattering blast as God is going to bring judgment after judgment after judgment upon, first of all, the Christian Roman Empire, who would be worse than the pagans could ever be. What an astounding thing, brothers and sisters. And therefore, this would be the result of the blowing of the four wind trumpets of Revelation 8. This is the end result. There are the barbarian kingdoms of 526 AD. Now, we've got here that the Western Empire ended in 476. I would rather suggest, brothers and sisters, that the empire began to be eclipsed in 476. And like all eclipses, it is a slow process fading out and then fading back in again. Now, here is the result of the 8th chapter. There are the Visigoth barbarians. There are the Burgundians. There are the Franks. There are the Ostrogoths. There are the Vandals. A direct result of the four wind trumpets blowing upon the Latin west of the Roman Empire. And we read, brothers and sisters, in this seventh seal, as it opens up in chapter 8, we read the words that it says, as the chapter opens, there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour. What does that mean? John listens, he hears nothing, and there is silence, not for half an hour, about a half an hour. Now, I need to track through this reasonably quickly. I usually take probably about 5 or 10 minutes to go through this. You're Texans, you can keep up. You need to get the chart a little bit later on. If you've got any questions about this, please do ask me about this later. I'm going to track through it as simply as I can, as quickly as I can, and let's see if we can digest this. Well, brothers and sisters, looking at the half an hour, we know there are 12 hours in a Jewish day. Jesus said that. We were to turn up the record, which we won't, in John 11 and verse 9, Jesus answered and said, "Are there not 12 hours in a day?" 12 hours in a Jewish day? 12 hours in a Jewish night. It's silence for about a half an hour. Well, let's build that up. 12 hours in a Jewish day, therefore 1 hour is a 12th of a day. A half an hour is a 24th of a day. Pretty simple. Now, if we were to apply a day for a year principle, and the warrant is very, very justifiable, because quotations like Genesis 47 and 9, Numbers 14:34, Ezekiel 4, verses 4 through 6, and Luke 13, verses 32, I won't enunciate those, you can turn them, all show us very clearly that the Bible uses a principle of a day for a year, and we apply that in the apocalypse in this instance. So, we've got a half an hour is a 24th of a day. Let's apply the day for a year principle. 12 hours, 12 months. Day, year. 1 hour is a 12th of the day, as 1 month is a 12th of a year. Therefore, 1 hour is 30 days. A half an hour being a 24th of a day, well, a half a month is a 24th of a year, or 15 days. So, a half an hour based on a day for a year principle is 15 days. A single conversion. Happy with that? Stay with me. Don't drift out. Then, brothers and sisters, we doubly convert. If you want to know what that means, talk to me later. We did this with the young people yesterday. We then doubly convert, and there are time periods in the apocalypse where you convert once, then you convert again. Well, here's the single conversion. A half an hour is 15 days. We then convert again. 15 days is 15 years. So there it is. But it doesn't say there was silence in heaven for a half an hour. It says there was silence in heaven for about the space. Don't waste words in the Bible. And therefore, brothers and sisters, we submit to you, and we believe we are on rock solid ground. I've had School of the Prophets with young brethren, and we've gone through this time period and challenged them to come up with any other time period than this, and you can't. This is it. absolutely it. Therefore, brothers and sisters, 15 days is 15 years, about the space of half an hour is 14 years, and we are talking the 14 years, as we showed on the chart, between Constantine's rule over the Christian world and the time that he dies. Silence in the political heavens for about the space of half an hour. Now you can get that chart and go through that. We went through it a little quickly, but we need to do because time is the enemy. So, brothers and sisters, there we are. Chaos as the sixth seal closes, and silence in the political heavens between 324 and 337. And when Constantine dies, the chaos is back. Very quickly, we looked at this a couple of studies ago. When the silence disappears and Constantine dies, the chaos is back. Verse 5, Revelation 8. And the angel took the censer and filled it with the fire of the altar and cast it to the earth, and there were voices, thunderings, and lightnings. There it is. Voices, thunderings, and lightnings. AD 337. The silence has passed. It's now chaos. So thunderings and lightnings is AD 337 with the death of Constantine. And as we saw before, the earthquake is the nephew of Constantine who would come in AD 361. And he would shake the political arena for 2 years by bringing back paganism, which then was removed and Christianity came back. How are you doing out there? Good. We did say coffee was the order of the day yesterday, and I saw brethren and sisters intravenously having coffee out there in the foyer, which was a very, very good idea. All right, brothers and sisters, something else we need to just come to terms with respect to chapter 8, so we really understand the detail, and that is this. I want to give you an overview now of chapter 8, as we've had just been introduced now to the context of chapter 8. Now, what we see in Revelation 8, we see this very interesting expression, the third part, runs all the way through chapter 8, you see. It's a very important theme which we want to tap into. Now, we make the note, we're looking at the four wind trumpets of chapter 8, and we make the note here that in AD 326, when Constantine moved the seat of his empire to Byzantium, there, which would become Constantinople in 330, from this time, the empire was divided into three parts. A third. That's a theme that runs through chapter 8. A third, you see. Now, the three divisions of the empire when Constantine moved to Constantinople, we had the Latin West. They spoke Latin. The Roman Catholics. They based their religious structure on the pagan emperor Diocletian. You will hear the echo, Diocletian. That was the Latin third. Over here we have the Hellenic East. They spoke Greek. Philosophically was their religion. And the debates between Athanasius and Arius, is Jesus a god, is Jesus a man, raged among the bishops of Alexandria and the bishops in Constantinople and Antioch. And they were extremely deeply involved in their philosophical approach to their religion. You couldn't go to the baker shop or the butcher shop lest they asked you the question, who is Jesus? Is he a god? Is he a man? Greek-speaking Hellenic East, you see. And then we have the Hellenized East. They are superficially Greek and hence became easy prey when the Saracens swept out of Arabia. They swept into Palestine as the fifth trumpet, as the children of the desert. The Saracens swept across the north of Africa and converted very easily these superficial Greek-speaking people. A third. Now let's have a look at how that pans out in Revelation chapter 8. Good to get our colouring and pencils out if you're inclined to do that, which we would suggest is a very, very good idea. But you don't have to. But if you do, you're doing a good job. But if you don't, we're not going to condemn you for it. All right, brothers and sisters. Now, you won't see the text there, but here are our four wind trumpets. Called wind trumpets, by the way, when you go to Revelation 7 and verse 1 and 2, we see the four angels holding back the winds of the earth. until the servants of God are sealed in their forehead. Hold back the four winds, it says in chapter 7. There they are, they're the four wind trumpets. Call poor judgment out on Christian Rome, particularly a certain section. Alrighty, four wind trumpets. Here's the first, verse 7. The first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled in blood, as it should be. This would be Alaric and his Visigoths. Now you'll note, brothers and sisters, that he would come and he would burn up a third part of trees. We have the next wind trumpet in verse 8. The second angel sounded as it were a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea. This mountain would be Genseric or Gaiseric, the Vandal. And so this great mountain that would be ripped out of the earth and cast into the sea and set on fire, which we'll consider, God willing, tomorrow morning, he would be the leader of the Vandal pirates, which would be the scourge of the Mediterranean Sea in his day. Now notice this. A third part of the sea became blood. A third part of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died. A third part of the ships were destroyed. You see the theme, you see? We had then the third wind trumpet in verse 10. And the third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp or a torch, a meteor. And it fell upon the third part of rivers. Well, this would be Attila and his mob of Huns. And you see, brothers and sisters, not only was he called a meteor, but he was called wormwood. And he would make the waters bitter. More about that tomorrow. Now look at the thirds. A third part of the rivers and a third part of the waters became bitter or wormwood. And then we come to the fourth trumpet in verse 12. The fourth angel sounded and a third part of the sun was smitten. This would be Theodoric and his band of Ostrogoths, the Eastern Goths, you see. Now look at the thirds here. Now be very careful here. A third part of the sun was smitten, a third part of the moon, a third part of the stars, so as the third part of them was darkened. Now be very careful. Don't go excitedly and enthusiastically and colour in that third down there. Don't colour that in, because that third part down there is a time period. These are not time periods. These are parts of the empire. So we've deliberately not coloured in the last third part down there, as it should not. It's not part of the brief that we're looking at the moment. So brothers and sisters, what are we saying? Well, we're simply saying that all of chapter 8 is about God's judgment on the Latin West, the Latin third. And God would bring these four Germanic barbarians across the Rhine and bring judgment on that third. You know, when you spill into chapter 9, you read here, the fifth angel sounded. Ah, now what we see here, brothers and sisters, at the end of verse 13 of chapter 8, we read, I beheld and heard an angel, or an eagle as it should be, flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth. If you think those four wind trumpets were bad, well, I'm telling you, there are three woe trumpets. They are going to be horrific, far more horrific than these four wind trumpets could ever be. And so we've got three woe trumpets, you see. And the first of those woe trumpets is the fifth trumpet there in verse 1. And this, brothers and sisters, would now be God using the Saracens in the first woe trumpet or the fifth trumpet, the Saracens who are going to now lop off this one third of the empire, the Hellenized East, as they stream out of Arabia and right up through North Africa. Then you see this third part continues into chapter 9. And therefore we see when we look at the sixth trumpet, which is the second woe, the sixth trumpet in verse 13, and what do we see? Here we see again the third part, verse 15. The third part, verse 18. And by these three, what three? Fire, brimstone, and smoke. Cannons. 1453, when the Turks would take Constantinople. So by these three were the third part of men killed. What third part? Well, there's Constantinople there, brothers and sisters. So in would come the Turks, in the sixth trumpet or the second woe trumpet. and they would come in and lop off the final third part of the Christian Roman Empire. What an amazing thing that is. So that's very important to have that established, brothers and sisters, in our minds. What is it, 12 o'clock? I looked at my watch then and I saw I only had 5 minutes. Don't do that to me. 5 minutes, no way. All right, brothers and sisters. Now the seven angels prepared themselves to sound. Now that's a very important word. So what we need in order for these four wind trumpets to do their work and to lop off the Latin third of the Roman Empire, we need barbarians on the border of the Rhine and on the border of the Danube. And the way that would happen is in this verse, God says there's a preparation first. So the seven angels, which had the seven trumpets, prepared themselves to sound. And this would happen, brothers and sisters, through the instrumentality of the Huns. And the Huns would come from the areas of Siberia, the grasslands or the steppes of Siberia, the non-mountainous, non-forested lands. There are some experts that say the Huns may have migrated from China, from the Han or Han dynasty. We don't know for sure, but we certainly know that the Huns migrated way, way, way from the east. And as the Huns moved, brothers and sisters, as they made their move westward, people were absolutely in horror of the Huns. Nobody liked the Huns. Even the barbarians, the Visigoths and the Ostrogoths and the Alans and the Gepidi, they wanted to get out of the way of the Huns. The Romans didn't like the Huns. They were an awful people. And as the Huns moved westward, the Germans call it the Völkern Wanderung, the wanderings of the people. And as the Huns pressed westward, the barbarians were forced to move and to move, and they were squeezed against the border of the Roman Empire. Well, Fisher, in his Geography, says this with respect to the history of Europe. Page 111, Fisher says this with respect to the Huns. He says they were a wild Mongolian people riding on stout ponies out of Central Asia in the latter part of the 4th century, and they made their way over the steppes into southeastern Europe, slaying and plundering as they rode these ugly, merciless creatures known as the Huns. You know, you pick up historical writings and they talk about the Huns and they say they are ugly creatures with dwarf-like frames on skinny legs. That's how they describe the Huns. They were awful. They were ugly, brothers and sisters. And what the young people used to do, the young boys, is they used to scrape their faces as they were adolescents with knives and stones so they wouldn't grow hair on their face when they got older. And they used to ride into battle wearing rat skin helmets. Could you imagine them? These dwarf-like frames on skinny-legged, ugly, scar-faced, rat skin helmet things riding. Would you be scared? You bet you would, brothers and sisters. Would you get out of the way? Oh, yes, you would. And the record here in the historian says, well, the Huns came and they swept every obstacle before them like chaff before an eastern gale. We're talking about wind trumpets. The Alans, the Ostrogoths, and the Visigoths felt successively the force of a thrust, spreading tremors throughout the whole German world and leading to those great but obscurely chronicled movements of the German peoples, for which for a time submerged Gaul and Britain, Spain, Africa and Italy. Well, they were going to sweep the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths. And for those who know a bit about history, you will know that a Visigoth is a Western Goth. This vest. They're all Goths. But Visigoths are Western Goths. Ostrogoths, ah, you're from the Eastern Goths. So Western Goths and Eastern Goths. Well, brothers and sisters, now would come the first wind trump. We've now got the barbarians pressed against the border as they're trying to get out of the way of the Huns, as the angels are preparing for these wind trumpets. So we pick up the record, Revelation 8 and verse 7. And the first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled in blood. And they were cast upon the earth, and a third part of trees was burnt up, and all green grass was burnt up. You know, brothers and sisters, we could do very well to go to one Old Testament quotation to pick up this idea of hail and fire mingled with blood. I want you to turn with me, if you will, to Isaiah 28 and verse 2. And as we're turning up Isaiah 28 and verse 2, I want you to think about this. Here in Revelation 8 and verse 7, this is the first time in the apocalypse that God is going to bring judgment on Christian Rome. Babylon the Great, soon to be called. Christian Rome, Babylon. Now keep that in mind. That's the first time in the apocalypse. Babylon. Alrighty. Now Isaiah 28, and we read these words, brothers and sisters, when I turn up Isaiah 28, and we read the words in verse 2. Behold, Yahweh hath a mighty and strong one, which has a tempest of hail and a destroying storm. There's your language. Revelation 8, you see. As a flood of mighty waters overflowing shall cast down upon the earth with the hand. Brothers and sisters, God is going to bring a hailstorm, a destroying hailstorm. God is going to bring war here to the 10 tribes of the north through the king of Assyria. Why? What have the 10 tribes done that was so bad that God is going to bring this awful devastation of this hailstorm? What had they done? Well, quite frankly, brothers and sisters, these 10 tribes were drunk. And because they were drunk, they were ignorant. Or you have a look at verse 8 of Isaiah 28. All tables are full of vomit and filthiness, so there's no place clean. Could you imagine going into the cafeteria and all the tables are full of vomit? Full of vomit! It's awful, brothers and sisters. And that's what God saw as he looked down from heaven. What were they doing? Ignorant. Well, look in verse 9. They were saying this. Who's going to teach knowledge? Who's going to make to understand doctrine? Them that are mature, those that are weaned from the milk, those that are drawn from the breasts. You know, brothers and sisters, these people on Isaiah's day were saying these words in verse 10. Precept must be upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, line upon line, here a little and there a little. Rotherham translates that verse as a drunkard's song. And there are the people in Isaiah's day, and they're drunk and they're staggering around. They're going, oh, who's going to teach us knowledge? Don't you give us anything heavy. We don't want meat. We just want a little bit of milk. Don't give me Zechariah, I'll throw up. Don't give me Daniel. No way give me Daniel. Revelation? Absolutely not. Do you want me to vomit all over the table again? They were on milk, brothers and sisters. And God says, ignorant. And I tell you what, the ignorance of this people was such that in Isaiah's day, Ephraim had been corrupted, not through wine, literally, but the doctrine of Babylon. Babylon, that's where God's bringing his judgment, brothers and sisters, on Christian Rome. And the effects of their ignorance through the doctrine of Babylon are very evident as you turn the page to verse 17 of Isaiah 28. And you read these words in verse 17. Judgment also will I lay to the line, and righteousness to the plummet. Now listen to this, here's the expression. The hail shall sweep away the refuge of lies. The waters shall overflow the hiding place. Here, brothers and sisters, in Isaiah's day, they found refuge in a lie, and falsehood became their hiding place. That's the second of Thessalonians in chapter 2. When the man of sin would be manifest, God said, I will send a strong delusion that they might believe a lie. There's your Babylon. There's your Catholic system. There's your man of sin. What an amazing tie-up. And there's much more, brothers and sisters, if we had the time to go through that. Well, here is God using these people to bring judgment on Babylon, just like Isaiah's day. Now, we don't have time, brothers and sisters, but when it says there would be blood, there would be fire mingled with blood, and it would be cast upon the earth, and the third part of trees would be burnt up first. If you were to go to Judges 9 and verse 8, which we won't, you would find that the men of Millo and the men of Shechem were in position of authority to elect a king. They elected Abimelech, the bramble. I won't turn that up. You can turn that up in your own time. But there was Jotham up on a rock, and he was looking down, and he gave a parable, and he said, "You men," and he called these elders of Millo and these elders of Shechem who were electing a king, he calls them trees. Trees. So we've got elevated vegetation. These were the rulers, and therefore God would bring judgment on the rulers with respect to this particular trumpet. Well, brothers and sisters, time's going really well. We're going to finish on time. I thought I'd gobble up 2 extra minutes, which I might anyway. Now look at the first trumpet and be amazed at the way God pours the history into his prophetic mold, and it takes his shape. What we read with respect to Alaric and his Visigoths. Now, don't be overwhelmed or persuaded by that photo there. You may not see it from back where you are anyway. You've got this great big horrible-looking monstrous beast there with a big helmet there and great big horns. Do you know, brothers and sisters, when the Visigoths came down, they came down and congregated in this area. They had wives, children. They were farmers. They were looking for pastoral land. They were getting out of the way of the Huns. They wanted refuge. They wanted safety. They weren't these big monstrous beasts that were going to gobble up people in their way. They're just getting out, they're people, getting out of the way of the Huns. And when they gathered against the Danube here, they had a choice. Do they stay on that side of the river, on that side of the border, and wait for the Huns to come down and take them as slaves, or worse, kill them? Or do the Visigoths appeal to the Romans and come across the Danube and know that when they do appeal to the Romans, and if the Romans are, well, if they're benevolent and allow them to come across, they know that they're going to have to give up their pagan gods. They know that they'll probably have to serve in the Roman army. They know that they'll probably have to be slaves to the Romans. What do you do? Do you face the Huns or do you face the Romans? Well, the choice was obvious. We need to call the Romans for help. And so what they did, brothers and sisters, they called on Valens, the Emperor Valens, who was reigning in Constantinople, the Christian Emperor Valens. And they said to the emperor, "Can we come across?" And he said, "Sure." But he wanted to show who was boss. So Valens came up and he said, "Some of you can come across. You can, and so can you. The rest of you, don't you cross that river or else." He was just puffing his chest out and just showing who was boss. Besides which, he didn't want too many Visigoths congregating in that area. They could revolt and become a threat. And besides which, he didn't want to have to feed them. It wasn't much food to go around for his own soldiers who were there manning the border of that territory, you see. So a number of Visigoths came across. Brothers and sisters, the Romans were awful to the Visigoths, and the Romans deserved what they got. Because what happened when the Visigoths, those who were allowed to come across, when they came across here, they were asylum seekers. And when they were here, brothers and sisters, the Roman soldiers were not interested in looking after or feeding them. But what they did do, the Romans went out and they hunted up stray dogs. And they got these stray dogs and they cut up the dogs, dog meat, and they offered dog meat to these Visigoths in exchange for their children to be used as slaves. You deserve what you get. And God was working. Could you imagine that? Selling your children for dog meat because you can't live? Well, that's how the Romans treated the Visigoths. You don't do that to barbarians. They won't hold that down for long, let me tell you. And they revolted. And revolt they did, brothers and sisters. And when they revolted, the Emperor Valens was caused to go in and try and sort it out. He was defeated. His Roman army were defeated. It was one of the greatest defeats in the Roman world. The Visigoths went berserk because of the way in which they were treated. Well, in come, with the death of Valens, in comes the great general Theodosius. And Theodosius was going to meet with the Visigoths and was going to settle the differences. And Theodosius said to them, "You can come across, only occupy that territory, and you can have a, well, concentration camp if you like." There's where they had to stay. Well, Theodosius died, and then his two sons began to rule in his stead. Arcadius in Constantinople, Honorius in Rome. Arcadius absolutely hated the Visigoths. He said, "There's a pay cut. Everyone in the Roman army who was a Visigoth will never, ever be promoted. So what Arcadius was going to do now, he was going to, by attrition, get rid of the Visigoths once and for all. Well, they revolted. So what the Visigoths did, brothers and sisters, they grabbed Alaric or Alaric. They whopped him on the top of their shield as a testimony that he is now our king. And in they went to Constantinople, and they were going to take Arcadius in 395 AD. In come the Visigoths in AD 395. They're going to take Constantinople. But Constantinople had been reserved for the Turks. God had deemed that they would be taken by the Turks in 1453. So there was no way the Visigoths could take Constantinople, but they're pumped full of adrenaline. They want to fight. So the Visigoths do an about-face, 180 degrees, and they go into Macedonia. And as they come into Macedonia, brothers and sisters, they hit a brick wall. And the brick wall that they hit was the great general Stilicho, the Roman general, who knew how to deal with barbarians, because Stilicho was a half-barbarian. He was a Vandal. And here's the great Roman general Stilicho. They banged into him, and Stilicho kicked out the Visigoths above the Danube. Well, the Visigoths came back in 402. They came into Milan. Guess what? Stilicho was there. He's everywhere. And Stilicho kicked out the Visigoths, brothers and sisters. Well, anybody in Rome who's too good and starts to shine above others, people will do you in as good as look at you. And they did. His own men killed Stilicho because he was too good, and he showed up the inadequacies of the rest of them. And Stilicho was the only one that could do with the barbarians. And when Stilicho is snuffed out, in they come, fellas, open the gates, and down come a swarm of barbarians into this area here. Not the Visigoths. They're waiting to see what would happen. Nothing. Let's go. So in come the Visigoths, and they come to Ravenna, and then they come to Rome in 408. And they sat around the city and waited. And inside the city, they starved. And inside the city of Rome, they began to eat their own children. That, brothers and sisters, is AD 70 revisited. Here, for the first time in 800 years, the queen of the world has got barbarians at her gates. And the Visigoths came, and the people in Rome said, "What are you doing here? What do you want?" And Alaric said, "I want money. I want land. I want recognition." They gave him money and he went away. A year later, he was back. They said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "You're crooked, the lot of you. I want money, I want land, and I want recognition." They threw him a pile of money and he went away. A year later, he's back again in 410. They said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "You're crooked, the lot of you. You're deceitful. I want what I want. I want money, land, and recognition." They said, "We've got no money." He said, "Well, I'll stay." And he did. And when they took Rome, brothers and sisters, the angels were there. Because when they took Rome, this is what Gibbon says. Alaric marched to the gates of Rome. At the hour of midnight, the Salarian gate was silently opened. An angel did that. And the inhabitants were awakened by the tremendous sound, this is an historian, by the Gothic trumpet. Brothers and sisters, an angel caused the pen of that historian to write trumpet, so that you and me in 2015 can stand here and say, what a book we have before us. And therefore, brothers and sisters, when Alaric came in, now look what he says about himself. "It is not me. It is not me that doeth this thing." Alaric said, "It is not of mine own will that I do this. There is one who forces me on and will not let me rest, bidding me spoil Rome." That's Alaric. And Alaric was an Arian Christian. And he hated the Trinitarians. And God used an Arian Christian to sack Rome, who were Trinitarians. What an amazing thing, brothers and sisters. Well, we'll finish our study on this note. Here in 410, in the book Hodgkin, the Theodoric the Goth, as he writes about in this instance Alaric, pages 16 through 17, the bare fact that Rome itself, the Roma Eterna, the Roma Invicta of 1,000 coins of 100 emperors, Rome, whose name for centuries on the shores of the Mediterranean had been synonymous with worldwide dominion, should herself be taken, sacked, dishonoured by the presence of a flaxen-haired barbarian conqueror from the north? Was one of those events apparently so contrary to the very course of nature itself that the nations which heard the tidings, many of them old and bitter enemies of Rome, now her subjects and friends, held their breath with awe at the terrible recital. Awe, and well they should, because they were in the very presence of God at work through the angels, brothers and sisters. And all God says in the book of Revelation, and the first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled in blood, and they were cast upon the earth, and the third part of trees was burnt up, and all green grass. What an astounding thing. Well, brothers and sisters, God willing, in our final study tomorrow, we're going to finish off the eighth chapter and stand in awe at the detail as we track through the Vandals, the Huns, and the Ostrogoths and see why it is necessary that we should ever deal with a subject like this as we await the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ.